You settle upcoming the first annual Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, and I know this was established as an alternative to both the National Book Awards and the replacement to those awards, TABA. How are you coming in reaching a decision?
Well, the decision, the nominations have already been made, and we're delighted. We plan to make them at least 2 months ahead of the final announcement of the winner, because one of the things that had been a problem with the National Book Awards was that the nominations were not publicized. And when the nominations weren't publicized, people didn't order the books, so that when you won the NBA, there were no books around. And one of the things we want to do is honor all of the nominees by having our paid promotion and having our main publicity at nomination level, because we figure that the winning level can take care of itself. And once the winner's been announced, then, as I say, books are already in the stores. We've been in touch with Dalton's and Walden Books, with Ingram, with Baker and Taylor, the big wholesalers, to see that they know about this well ahead of time.
In fact, that was the case with Tim O'Brien after he won for his book.
Going After Cacciato.
I went out to look for it, and I couldn't find it anyplace.
When I won the NBA in 78 for Blood Tie, there was not one copy in a bookstore in New York. And I said to my publishers, why aren't there any copies? I mean, I would have taken a box and taken a car and taken them from store to store, but they don't have that kind of spirit in publishing houses anymore. You know, no fun, no get up and get.
What is it with publishing or in publishing that makes books of literary excellence often so hard to find?
Well, I think one of the things is that they've got some kind of extremely parochial New York publishing idea that a good book won't sell. Now, I've been all over the country, you know, doing interviews and so forth for The Scapegoat, and one of the great complaints in bookstores around the country is that they don't know what's going on. And they find it extremely hard to order books. And when you see what modern book ordering is, you see what they're up against. For instance, about 80% of all the books ordered from the publisher, advance orders, are done at least 5 months before the book comes out. Now that means, and this is the big ones, this is Walden Books, Dalton's, Ingram, Baker and Taylor, Brentano's, a few of the great big people who distribute books and who have chains all over the country. They buy long before even the trade reviews come out, much less the critics. So by the time the trade reviews and the critics come out, you have to go through a long and slow process of ordering the books, say, direct from the publisher or whatever. In other words, the reader has to be extremely patient about getting their book, because it's not going to be in the stores unless the publisher, 5 months ahead of any criticism, any prizes, any talk, anything, has decided that that book is going to sell. So it's a kind of, I call it a dictatorship of managers. And they sit in a little room and they decide this book will sell and that book won't. And the message that they send, anybody can see that message in Publishers Weekly. It's an ad 5 to 6 months ahead of time, and it says, so and so many copies in print, so and so much paid promotion. Now what the book is called, what the quality of it is, who wrote it, none of that matters.
Well, those words serve as signals to the bookseller.
Darn right. I wrote an article about this and compared the pre-publication ads to those ads in the back of weekly magazines that say, aggressive male seeks compliant, intelligent friend. You know, it's all a ghastly secret language.
I have a feeling, though, in reading the bestseller list, that books are real literary excellence don't appear too often. I noticed, however, that E.L. Doctorow's Loon Lake has been on the bestseller list for months now.
Well, Loon Lake's been on it for a very good reason. I mean, it's been on it in spite of it being a very fine book. And that's because Random House totally backed that book with a large-scale paid promotion, with large ads, and the whole thing. I think there are other ways to get to the public, and I think in many ways it's the public's fault, because if they're going to allow a literary dictatorship of a few New York publishing managers, then they deserve what they get. And any good reader of books ought to go to their bookstores want to sell books. They ought to go to their bookstores and demand that those books be ordered and wait for them. And then gradually, this scene will be changed.
Yet, a book these days is a very large investment.
You're darn right.
About $15.
So why should they take a substitute? Why, when they want to? Let's look at that list. Those are fine books. It's a good Catholic list of nominations. If they want to read Shirley Hazzard's book, which, by the way, is around in the stores now, or Walker Percy's Second Coming, Sorrentino's Aberration of Starlight, John Kennedy Toole, A Confederacy of Dunces, which is absolutely one of the funniest books ever written, or How German Is It of Walter Abish, they ought to be able to go into a bookstore and get it. Now, these are the nominations for the Penn Faulkner Award. Book lovers ought to be able to buy those books, read them, and decide for themselves.
By your experience, are these books that have been nominated by the Penn Faulkner Awards, are they readily available now?
Some of them are and some of them are not. Walker Percy's book came out some time ago, and I don't know whether hardcover copies are still available in the stores or not. They ought to be made available at once.
You said something that is shared by many writers, that publishers often do not provide a commitment to the books that they sell. And yet, I have talked to publishers who say, you cannot sell a book that will not sell. You cannot promote, for example, the telephone directory because people just won't read it.
Now, that's their excuse, and they're absolutely right about that. Of course, and what they're saying is you can't... literary is a terrible word, by the way, in the publishing business. You know, it's a real killer word. And I think it shows an incredible contempt for book lovers all over the country that it is a killer word. Of course they can't sell a book that the public doesn't want, but they can try to sell a book that the public might want if they knew it existed.
Your current publisher is Random House, and you've gone through a number of publishers. Have you had words with your publishers in the past over the way they've approached your books?
I certainly have. I'm, as you know, a very good example of someone who the publishers decided, every single one of them decided ahead of time, that I was too good for the common man. And this made me mad as hell because I write stories. As you know, Don, there's stories. They have a beginning and a middle and an end, and there's death and love and strikes and the works in these stories. But the publishers decided that I was a great literary figure. Therefore, I would be kept very, very quiet. And I don't like this. I think it's an insult to me and an insult to the public. When I won the National Book Award, there were 4,000 copies of my book in print, and most of them had already been sold. Now, this is after so and so many novels.
How has The Scapegoat done over the last couple of months since we talked last?
Very well. Very well, because I think one of the reasons it's done very well is that it touches a subject that's been very little written about in this country. Here we have a whole, I think we talked about this before, we have this whole vast labor history behind us. We come out of the early trade union movement in this country in many ways. I don't know whether you're a member of a union. I'm a member of the Authors Guild, and it's got a fancy name, but all it is an authors union. You know, to pressure, to get good contracts and stick together, and same thing Mother Jones was talking about to the miners. That, except by people who were the muckraking writers of the turn of the century or in the 20s, you know, they were propaganda writers, has been very little questioned by American writers, and I think this is one of the reasons people like the book.
I don't know if I asked you this the last time we talked, but who are the writers who most influenced you?
They're a strange lot. Joseph Conrad certainly is my, I hope, greatest influence. I lived for many, many years in England, and so my knowledge of English and European literature is a lot greater than my knowledge of American, or used to be a lot greater. Then I started reading American books to find out who my cousins were, and I found some pretty good ones. But that sense of form, not an imposed form on a book, but a form that comes out of the content of the book, I think comes from a lot of European reading, Proust, for instance.
I was reading the other day a very interesting book that had been published about 1935 or 36 for the Modern Book Collector, and the author of this book lists his choices of collectible writers. And looking at this book, 45, 46 years after it was published, I noticed that perhaps 90% of the writers that he chose as collectible for the Modern Book Collector have completely vanished.
Mm-hmm.
And nowhere in the book did he mention Fitzgerald, Steinbeck, who had not written Grapes of Wrath at that point, but he had written a number of successful books. He mentioned Hemingway in passing, saying that Hemingway was writing trash and that William Faulkner could not be understood, and all of the other collectible authors of the period, and the author in this particular writer's mind, have completely vanished.
Mm-hmm.
I think writing sometimes can be very perishable, can't it?
Yes, I've had this experience with where we are collating a library right now, my husband and I. And here are the books that it is an experience in humility for a writer who's had a book out that year and had the book heavily praised to read the blurbs on the back of a book that's been totally forgotten, that was published in 1949. Writer forgotten, book forgotten, and on the back the critics have said, superb, great American novel, you know. So on. And all right, let's come back to the fact that these managers, I refuse to call them editors because the editing in most publishing houses is done by working editors, not the decision makers. These decision makers are keeping, I think, the kind of books away from the public that might survive, that have a very slow sale and a very slow spread of reputation.
And yet, taste changed, and so do writers. They also changed. For example, Harold Robbins was considered highly literary when he began. I think his first book was A Stone for Danny Fisher, I believe.
That's right.
James Michener, although very popular in the same way that Robbins is today, is considered by many of the critics kind of a pro forma writer in that he researches.
I am really rolling up my sleeves on this one. Michener, Wook, Harold Robbins are perfect examples of people who have been, whose reputations have been killed the other way around by literary snobbery, and I despise it just as much for the saving of books. All three of those writers are extremely serious writers, and let me try and define serious writing in this way. I think that serious writing is done by people who take a topic or find a question, not an answer, a question, and seek the answer to that question through writing. Now, that defines Michener's work. Michener will try and find out about South Africa, or was it Wook? Who wrote Trinity?
Leon Uris.
Uris is another example of this. These people may not stylistically be what the literary snobs or even the judges of the Penn Faulkner Award this year think are good writers. I take them extremely seriously as writers. And I think for the literary snob, to put them in the same boat with the Princess Daisies and the Gothic romances and, all those highly touted what used to be called penny dreadfuls or dime novels, I think is an insult to them. And it's just as bad for those of us who are on this on this list for this award for fiction, or me, or Tim O'Brien, or any of us, to be categorized as unreadable literary writers simply because we try and be good writers. You see what I'm getting at? There are schisms that have been made by, I think very often made by people being critical who haven't read the books. Somebody made a snob remark about Michener to me the other day, and I said, look, when any of us keep a reader up till 4 o'clock in the morning reading, then let's come back and talk about Mr. Michener. You see my point, don't you?
Tell me about you. You have, I saw an article in the New York Times, a photograph of you sitting in your workroom.
Working.
Yes, working. In the attic space, and obviously you are. Can you give us a hint about what you're working on now?
Yes, I'm working on the last book of my quintet. You know, we talked about that. The Scapegoat was the fourth book of the quintet. And by the way, the whole quintet, thank God, is being published in paperback, starting with Prisons in April, and with Know Nothing, with Obulaland in July, Know Nothing in October, the paperback of The Scapegoat in January, next January, 82. And the last book of the quintet will be called The Killing Ground. And it's one section of that book, I think it's the third section of the book, is the has in it the material of the old Fight Night on a Sweet Saturday. But the book is about three times the size of that and will come up to 1980 and to the next turnover of ownership of that one valley.
How do you discipline yourself to work every day?
Go upstairs and stay there. But I might go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the main discipline is, it's like the discipline of dieting is in the supermarket. Mm-hmm. If you don't take it home, you can't eat it. If I'm not up in that room, I can't write about it. I may stay up there morning after morning and not write, because I am an intuitive writer. I don't write by will. But going up there to the room, Mark Twain said, genius was the seat of the pants and the seat of the chair. I just go up there and lie down and hope.
Do you ever find yourself in the position of starting to write and you cannot stop? You must continue and...
Oh, yes.
The clock goes past midnight. And...
Oh, no, because I stop myself when the energy's gone. Anything of mine written on nerves after that first ebullient energy is gone is no good. On the other hand, I have written the last chapter of several books by writing for an hour, sleeping for 2 hours, writing for an hour, sleeping 2 hours, writing for an hour, sleeping 2 hours, right through a 24-hour period.
Are you a firm believer in rewrite?
Oh, boy, I certainly am. Yes, but I'm not a believer in rewrite during the first draft of a book. I think it's very important to get the pace and the kind of tensile strength of the first draft of a book down on paper. Then you've got it out there. You can look at it. You can reform it. You can tighten it. You can make it more alive. After all, this the Killing Ground has, in effect, taken me 15 years to write.
How do you work with an editor? What kind of relationship do you have during the editing process of your books?
I love the editing process, and I'm very lucky because Roger Shattuck, you know, who wrote the two books on Proust, wonderful, wonderful critic, and he's also this year written a book about the wild boy of Avignon. It's really a book about articulation and how you can educate. I'm a great admirer of his, and he has written the introduction to the quintet for Ballantine paperback. I get a reading from three people, from Ann Beeney, Roger Shattuck, and my husband, before an editor ever sees a book. And they read it carefully for me, which is just wonderful. It goes back to the old 19th century thing, which what writers used to do is read each other's work before a publisher ever saw it. I take a fix on what they've said, and that gives me a sense of the strength and the weaknesses of the book. And then I take it to the editor, and my last two books have been edited by Rob Cowley, when he was at Houghton Mifflin, and the last one at Random House. And I like working with Rob a lot. He's a very good linear editor.
Well, I wonder about that, because I find I have been working on my second novel. My first one is on a shelf or a drawer someplace, I can't remember, where it will always remain. My second
one... Mine was refused by every American publisher, my first novel, and then it was published as my second novel and went through two editions. So don't get rid of that manuscript.
Well, my second one, I completed about 130 pages, and I played it off of people, some colleagues at the office, and my wife, and this sort of thing. And maybe I don't react well to criticism, but I find myself so demoralized in listening to the criticism.
Yeah, I think you're making a mistake, Don. I don't think anybody should show anything of a book until the first draft is on paper. See, because what you're showing is something that's only half formed. Mm-hmm. And I did that with my first novel. The first novel I ever wrote, I showed 100 pages to a publisher with a synopsis for the rest of the book. And he read it, and he had a lot of suggestions about how that book should end. And it absolutely killed it in my mind. I'm lazy. I thought, well, if he knows how it's going to end, why should I worry about it?
So it's best to plow through. Get it fixed
absolutely in your mind. Get it fixed. You're on your own until the whole book's down on paper. Then show it to other people.
Tell me about the young people that you are educating at the University of Virginia. You are teaching...
I teach one term a year there. I teach a writing course. I think the level of students at the University of Virginia is just extraordinary now. Of course, this is a course that they choose. But I have had nothing good experiences about teaching the students. And what I like is that there'll be two pre-law students and a pre-med student and so on, all in. Because I don't like teaching graduate writing courses. I won't do it. Undergraduate courses, I don't care whether they're ever going to write or not. But I think it makes such good readers out of people if they've had the experience of writing stories and having them edited. And there's certain things that they learn to look for.
You mentioned the belly button syndrome the last time we talked. What do young writers like to write about, the ones who are still forming themselves intellectually?
They're not writing confessional stories, not in my class anyway. I told them I didn't want to hear that they all had the same confessions to make. And if I think we talked about this, there are only 10 sins, and they're all pretty boring once you've heard about them enough times. No, they're writing stories. Which is wonderful.